it's pretty clear that the Russians, at least with regard to war with NATO, they're not planning for the type, for the kind of war that we're seeing right now in Ukraine. So a war where Russia goes full strength into the country, tries to occupy it at large scale, and then impose its political will after physically destroying the adversary's capability to resist.
Du hører på Liberal Halvtime, en podcast fra Tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Mathilde Fasting, and today I'm joined by Fabian Hoffmann. He is a PhD scholar at the Oslo Nuclear Project at the University of Oslo. A little while ago, I read a Twitter X thread in 20 steps, where Fabian outlined a possible Russian war strategy. This will be the topic of our conversation, and we will also include some comments about the Baltic of Kaliningrad and of the Suwalki corridor. This is a podcast in this year's series about countries around Russia, their history, their relationship with Russia, and their future, and of course, the war in Ukraine. Thank you for joining me today, Fabian.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go directly to your Twitter X thread, which, by the way, reached out more than 7 million people, as I have understood. Maybe it's even more now. What are your arguments, in short, before we go into the details?
Yeah, so basically what I'm looking at in the thread is the risk of a war between NATO and Russia. I think even though, you know, a lot of people looking at Ukraine, they understand that there, you know, certainly are risks when it comes to Russia. I think a lot of people still underestimate that there actually is a real risk of war between NATO and Russia in the coming years. I think a lot of people are too focused on what we call the capability dimension. So what's the state of Russia's army? And obviously it has been quite heavily weakened in Ukraine. And from that, they infer that a war with NATO is impossible. And what I try to argue and outline in the thread that is that actually there are a lot of factors to consider beyond this capability dimension that unfortunately make a war between NATO and Russia quite a bit more likely than I think many of us would like to assume.
Mm. Because you outline first of all, of course, some different phases of what that could look like, and also a time span. What are they, and what is the time span we're talking about here?
Yeah, so I think that's really important. I outline a time span of 2 to 3 years that we have to be in a position where we can effectively deter Putin and Russia. So what I'm not saying is that in 2 to 3 years, we will have war with Russia. I think that was sometimes misunderstood. This is really the time frame for us to get ourselves in a position where we can react to a worst case scenario that, you know, I think is quite plausible. I'm not saying it's extremely likely. I'm not saying it will definitely happen. But this is just something for us really to get ourselves ready and to be in a position where we can react proactively.
Before we go into what this warfare would look like and into the strategy itself that you think the Russians can follow, what are the ultimate Russian goals, you think, in this situation where we are now?
Well, I mean, right now it's about the subjugation of Ukraine, at least for the Ukrainian state in its current structure, to cease as a political entity, to become a puppet state of Russia in some way, or at least to become a buffer between itself and NATO. But then obviously, I think it is very clear at this point that Putin has bigger, larger ambitions beyond Ukraine. And that involves, you know, some of the other non-NATO states bordering Russia. But I think then what we've also heard from Russia in recent weeks and months has been very concerning, in the sense that they make it very clear over and over again that to them, Russia's borders, or the borders at least of the sphere of influence, do not stop at NATO's borders, and that they are absolutely willing and prepared to challenge that.
Are we talking about the old borders of the Iron Curtain?
That's a really difficult question, right, to go into geographic specifics. But I think it definitely relates to the former borders of the Soviet Empire or the Russian Empire, right? What Russia perceives as its rightful sphere of influence, where they should be able to basically tell states in their neighborhood how to behave. So I would say that most certainly includes the Baltics, probably also includes Poland and a couple of the other states that were within the Soviet sphere of influence or within the Soviet state. But yeah, so I think beyond that, it is quite difficult to speculate what exactly Russia's geographic goals at least would be.
You were talking about in an interview a kind of a strategic reconsideration of military influence or I guess I would say the strategic alliances that are in Europe right now, that is what Putin wants to change.
Yes, exactly. So I think, right, while it's a bit more difficult to speculate about the exact geographic boundaries that Russia would like to see, I think it is very clear to outline or what their political ambitions are. And that is to have NATO cease as a political entity, because obviously it is this military political alliance that gives those states in the former Russian sphere of influence strength to confront Russia and to stand up to Russia. And obviously without NATO as an entity as it is right now in its strength, of course, Russia's political objectives in its neighborhood would be a lot easier to achieve. So I think that is one of the clear short to medium term goals of Putin and the broader Russian decision maker entourage of Putin to have basically have NATO cease to exist.
We were talking about, or your thread was talking, you very briefly, of course, the different, what it would look like, this warfare. And I see that you mentioned a strategy including a land grab. We could do that on a general level and then come back to the Baltics, which we are going to talk about later. But then, and also nuclear threats, of course. So those are elements in this strategy. What is the strategy exactly?
Yeah, so I mean, what this strategy dates back to is basically, if you look at the Russian literature on military strategy, on defense policy, on technology, military technologies, over the last 1 to 2 decades, it's pretty clear that the Russians, at least with regard to war with NATO, they're not planning for the type, for the kind of war that we're seeing right now in Ukraine. So a war where Russia goes full strength into the country, tries to occupy it at large scale and then impose its political will after physically destroying the adversary's capability to resist. Right? Even though, you know, a lot of propagandists within the Kremlin, they talk about over and over again how Russia will march from Tallinn to Lisbon, so all the way through European NATO. Basically, the intellectuals and also the decision makers, right, outside of this propaganda bubble, they know that this is not realistic. They know that the conventional balance of power on the European continent, even without the Americans, is quite heavily skewed in favor of NATO. And obviously, right, if you have the Americans intervene, this conventional balance of power only becomes more and more skewed. So Russian intellectuals and decision makers, I believe, they understand that in a prolonged land war with NATO, they would not be able to succeed. They would not be able to achieve their political objectives. So what they have been thinking about over these last 1 to 2 decades is, how do we get away with victory? How can we achieve our political objectives in a war with NATO before its conventional superiority comes to bear, and we're unwilling to stand up against that large force of the alliance? And basically, the solution that they came up with is, instead of bringing the adversary physically to its knees by, you know, comprehensively destroying the army, which again, they know is not realistic. They believe that through managing escalation, through imposing psychological pressure on NATO states, they might be willing to force very early on in a conflict between Russia and NATO negotiations where they could settle the conflict on terms favorable to Russia. This is not about fully and comprehensively defeating every single state of NATO. Rather, it is bringing Russia in a position where it can negotiate from a position of strength and where Western decision makers will be forced to give in.
What do you think the politicians in Europe and the US have got wrong? Why do you think they have got the wrong picture of what Russia will do? And then also, if you could make some comments about risk-taking, because as you know, and as we have been very clear for the past 2 years, the nuclear threats is there, and that's, of course, combined with a huge risk on both sides, of course. But why do you think the politicians in Europe, again, then why have they got this wrong? And why do they think that the conventional warfare will be like the warfare in Ukraine?
Yeah, it's a good question. Let's start with this idea of risk-taking and the risk-taking competition, because I think that plays a huge role, right? So basically what Russia, in the scenario that I outline and that I think is quite plausible, again, because that's what the Russians are talking about. What they basically say, for example, is that very early on in the conflict, they would try to seize a small chunk of territory, NATO territory, and then very aggressively, what they call sanctuarize it. So we get aggressive sanctuarization where they put their nuclear umbrella over this newly occupied territory and just immediately make clear, right, okay, whether this is a territory in Poland or the Baltics, basically signal to the Western European states and also to the Americans, if you come and try to reconquer that territory, if you try to take this away from us again, we will immediately use nuclear weapons, escalate to the nuclear level in order to deny your military strength and make sure that you cannot kick us out of that territory. Another thing that they, for example, talk about is so-called de-escalation strikes. So very early on in a conflict, they want to, or they say they might strike critical civilian infrastructure targets all over Europe, especially in the Western European states. And basically, that's a message that's signaling where they would try to tell Western European decision makers, hey, look, you're in a war with us right now. Right now, this war has just started, but this is already really, really costly for you. And this imposes a lot of pain on your civilian population. So, right, better than resisting, you start talking with us and you better start negotiating with us so that we can find a solution out of this conflict. The solution then, of course, being that the conflict would be settled on terms favorable to Russia. And basically what Russia is trying to do is not engaging with us in a large scale conventional competition of the armed forces, but this is a risk-taking competition. They're betting that we're not willing to take the risks necessary to successfully stand up to Russia, right? Because what they're betting is that we're not calling their bluff, essentially. They're thinking, look, if we just threaten these types of actions, aggressive nuclear sanctuarization, if we engage in these types of de-escalation strikes, this will impose such psychological pressure on Russian, on Western decision makers. This will make them so uncomfortable, especially given that in their eyes we're incredibly pain intolerant, that they're immediately willing to settle the conflict. And them believing that is really bad because it might tempt them to actually engage in this type of behavior. So basically our task is to call that bluff and tell them before the conflict starts, no, if you do that, there's no chance we're going to give in. You can threaten nuclear use, you can strike our civilian infrastructure, and we will strike back. We're not going to give in. We're not going to settle. So this is basically the task of our decision makers right now, to make this abundantly clear to Russia that they would not get away with this type of strategy. And now we get to the second point. I think, unfortunately, this is not what we're seeing right now. I think our decision makers, they're A, really slow to wake up to the conventional threat that Russia poses, right? So I think what we're doing right now, this rearmament effort, really is, right? This is good at large scale. This is useful. But this is kind of what we're doing to prepare for this type of conventional threat that we see right now in Ukraine, which again, right, this is useful. Of course, we need a general arms buildup again across all domains, across all areas. So I'm absolutely not against that. But I think what we also need is that we need our decision makers to prepare for these specific types of worst case scenarios, especially if they're quite plausible. And I think that's the case. And for them to do that effectively, they basically have to engage in this risk-taking competition with Russia right now. And we have to make them clear, no. We are willing to take risks. We're not just going to give in. If war breaks out and if you try these really, really risky strategies, right? Russian decision makers, they also know that's really risky strategy. They know that their de-escalation strikes, as they call them, on Western critical civilian infrastructure, there is a huge risk that this is not going to cause NATO to surrender. And instead, this is going to escalate the war very rapidly and involve Russia in a very large-scale war with NATO. So they know that there are risks. They're just betting that actually these risks are worthwhile taking because NATO decision makers are so weak. So basically, we have to make clear that no, we work here from a position of strength, and we're willing to play this game with you, and we're going to get away with a victory. This is how you deter Russia.
Do you think that, I know you're not studying psychology, of course, but you are studying nuclear strategy, so there's a lot of psychology in there. Do you think that when you look at the leaders, both in NATO and in Russia, who would you think would have, will be willing to take the biggest risk?
Yeah, I mean, deterrence, right, in the end is psychology, I would say. Or a lot of it is psychology. At least one significant factor. Deterrence, right, you can broadly conceptualize it as a mix of capability and resolve. So obviously capability comes down to what you have in your military arsenals, what you present your adversaries with, what you can throw at the adversary if push comes to shove, and resolve describes basically your willingness to remain steadfast, to stand up to the adversary if he tries anything funny. And so that's a very cognitive dimension, right? This is not something that I can physically establish. This is really something through my signaling, through how I behave, I have to make clear to the adversary that I am resolved. And if we look at different states in NATO, I think we see, for example, that the Eastern European states, they display a tremendous amount of resolve. They have made very clear from day one, before this war also, but especially once this war began in Ukraine, that this is how far it goes and no step further. And they are 100% willing to stand up to the challenge that Russia presents and also confront this challenge very aggressively in Ukraine already. So not just when it comes directly to the doorstep. And I think you then you can compare this to some of the other decision makers in NATO. So for example, Chancellor Scholz in Germany, or generally in Germany, right? If you look at the decision makers and some of the politicians there, they're still talking about, right? Is Ukraine even allowed to win? And to what extent can they win? To what extent can Russia lose before risks for us become too high? What kind of weapon systems can we deliver to Ukraine before risks of escalation becomes too strong? And I think, right, like all these actions, everything that signals is basically weakness and a lack of resolve to Russia. So I think that actually is really dangerous. And that's why I believe the way we behave right now with regard to Ukraine is not just dangerous for Ukraine, because obviously it could have huge implications with their ability to resist a prolonged war with Russia. But this is also very, very risky, because these are exactly the types of acts that can draw us into a one-on-one conflict with Russia, because right now we're basically signaling a lot of weakness to them, a lack of resolve, a lack of willingness to stand up to a bully. And I think that becomes very dangerous, very fast. And so I think, yeah, our decision makers in Western Europe, they should become a lot more like the Eastern European ones.
Do you think then it will help if you get a NATO leader from one of the Eastern European countries? That's a question that you might not have been looking into, but we know that Jens Stoltenberg is not going to be head of NATO more than, I guess, about 6 months from now, or even a bit more, but eventually now in 2024, it will be a change. So what role does the head of NATO, what does he or she have in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Jens Stoltenberg, I mean, he had a tremendously important function already prior to the war breaking out. There are some accounts that basically say that he was the guy that single-handedly held the United States in the alliance under Trump, or at least made sure that the credibility of U.S. protection over the European continent is not completely fading away. So that is, of course, it's a really important position. And then also, I mean, after the Ukraine war started, Stoltenberg is as far, right? I'm not an expert on NATO leadership and their role, generally speaking, and in this war. But from my understanding, he also played an important role in coordinating aid to Ukraine and making sure that individual NATO member states step up to the best of their abilities. So I think, right, it would be quite useful actually for the alliance, and this is my personal opinion, if we get one of these leaders that truly understand what it means to deal with Russia and how important it is to stand up to Russia. I understand, of course, right, that there are also broader considerations that flow into that. I mean, I can also see, for example, that if you have, you know, a head of state like Mark Rutte from the Netherlands, who I think is, you know, one of the top candidates, who of course then is, right, a bit closer to the Western European mindset. And then if you infuse that mindset with a bit of the NATO bureaucracy and the NATO view, how that can also have benefits, right? Like maybe he's then a bit of a mediator, that maybe someone from the Eastern European countries that has a very strong perspective already could not play. So I see, right, how there are benefits for both sides. I do think, however, the urgency of the situation right now demands probably a bit less of mediation and a bit more resolve. That's why I would appreciate, I think, someone from Eastern European countries. But again, I do understand how the other considerations and how this might not be entirely realistic.
Let's go into some of the countries around Russia. We'll start with Belarus. And the question is if Belarus is capable of withstanding pressure from Putin, and how likely it is that he will push Lukashenko onto the war against Ukraine, NATO, and then, I mean, including Belarus really in this conflict, and the making of course the border with NATO longer, because now it's just the Ukraine border, and of course we have the Baltics, but then Belarus is in the middle there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think with Belarus, it's quite difficult to read their position, or it's been quite difficult to read their position throughout these almost 2 years of war. I think obviously at the outset, it's very clear that they are a steadfast ally of Russia, that they are willing to help Russia basically where they can, economically and militarily. At the same time, politically, there have been attempts from Belarus quite a few times to reach out to the West, and what I perceive is also a bit like them trying to to separate themselves from Russia, making clear, no, look, we're still our own political entity. We are not simply a client state of Russia, and we are allowed and we're willing to have our own positions that may slightly differ from Russia. Obviously, Lukashenko knows very well that his political survival is intimately tied to what's going on inside Russia, and especially with the Putin regime. So obviously, Belarus is in a tricky position.
What do you think about the Baltics? We have said that this is, of course, a part of my series about the countries around Russia. And I know that the Baltic states are in your Twitter thread and in the interviews and in the examples that you have been using. So do you think that the Baltic states are more aware of what the Russians will do or might do? Or what do you think, or where in this area do you think that the Russians will attack? Because that is part of the land grab strategy that you explained a bit earlier in this conversation. So let's go into the Baltic.
Yeah, so I mean, the Baltics, right, compared to, I think, the rest of Europe, or at least Western Europe, I think they've never felt safe when it comes to Russia. Right? Like in the UK, Germany, France, Spain, these countries, Italy, probably also a bit, right, like of Sweden and Norway, we kind of felt that, no, the Russian threat really has receded after the Cold War, right? And at least the first two decades after the Cold War, and that this immediate threat that Russia and the Russian army poses, it's very negligible. I think that's something that the Baltics, they never felt that. I think they always knew that at least there is a potential for Russia to really reemerge as a threat, and a threat not just, you know, generally speaking to the security architecture in Europe after the Cold War, but a very existential, a very real threat to the survival of the state that the states that the Baltics represent. So I think in that sense, yeah, they've always looked at and engaged with Russia very differently than we've done it in the past. So in terms of the land grab scenario, yeah, I think, you know, the Baltics are obviously one of the areas where that could take place. I think it is important to make clear that for Russia, for the strategy that I outline, it's not necessary to fully conquer, let's say, all of the Baltics, or maybe even, you know, just one country. I think a substantial part of one Baltic state might already be enough to get the ball rolling. So what do I mean with that? It's probably a substantial part. Less than a country, probably should be a bit more than 1 to 2 kilometers behind the front line. So right, there needs to be like some sense of loss, and some sense of occupation, and some sense of conquer by Russia. So that could involve a bigger city, that could involve a larger square kilometer area, but obviously it's very difficult to pinpoint that. And again, really this land grab is only there to kind of get things rolling, and later to force NATO into negotiations. The initial land grab, at least, is not at all about what we're seeing right now in Ukraine, where really Russia is trying to normalize this new status quo, where it occupies a chunk of territory and then tries to annex that. I think that's very different from what we would see in a NATO-Russia conflict.
I just have, there's one thing, of course, with the Baltics. And if you know geography, it's really flat. It's quite easy to just roll in all of those three Baltic states. That's one thing that might be if you consider the easiest land grab with you, if you look at the Russian border, would be in that area because of geography. I'm just asking if that's part of the considerations that the Russians would do. And the other thing is, even though you said they won't occupy it for purposes of getting it as a part of Russia again, there are substantial populations in these three countries that are already Russian speaking and maybe have more ties to Russia than to the country that they now live in, or at least one of those three Baltic states that they might be inhabiting right now. So that's of course also a question of how these Russian speaking people in these countries, how they feel, what their identities are right now, 30 years after, I mean, they became independent. So do you have any thoughts on these dimensions?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, on this political dimension of, you know, Russian minorities living within these countries, I think that might be a great excuse for Russia to go for. In the end, whether, you know, like these people still actually feel some type of attachment to their Russian motherland or not, that would be very secondary, because in the end, that would just be an excuse by Russia. They don't really care about that. The flatlands, that's definitely a consideration. That could, in theory, indeed, it could make it easier to seize land fast by just, you know, quickly rolling in. But then the flip side of that is actually that this territory can also be quite easy to defend. Right, if you have, from a tactical perspective, if you force your adversary to advance over a very open, flat space, that leaves ample space to also engage that enemy. So that's, for example, why I believe, right, this is something what we really, really need to do with the Baltics. We need to establish a credible forward defense. And that is absolutely feasible. So with forward defense, I mean that, let's go a bit back, because this is quite an interesting point, actually. So with NATO, forward defense has always been, also during the Cold War, has always been the official objective. So forward defense means that you are defending the front line from hour zero onwards, and you are not purposely falling back. So you try to write like this saying, we defend every inch of NATO territory. This is what you're trying to do with forward defense. You're not falling back. You're defending the front line at the line of contact. So where you first make contact with the enemy. And basically, right, this is what the Americans told the West Germans during the Cold War, that we would be willing, and we are willing, and this is our objective, to defend West Germany right at the border with East Germany. So that was the official doctrine. Inofficially, there was a huge debate going on, okay, how realistic is that? And right, like a lot of people, like intellectuals, but also some policymakers, they inofficially understood And also, I think sometimes, even though I don't have perfect insights into the records, but I think it was fairly well known that in case the Soviet Union ever tries to cross the border, that probably, or it's likely that they would have some initial land gain, and that NATO would attempt to hold the Russian advance as long as possible while falling back. And then with American assistance coming across the Atlantic, then counterattack through southwestern Germany and basically trying to push back the Soviets or the Warsaw Pact to the status quo ex ante line. So that was then, right, like what they believed is maybe more realistic. And then after the Cold War, and when things heated up again with Russia after 2014, right? Again, NATO always publicly stated, no, we are going to defend every inch of NATO territory. We are going to defend the Baltics right in Baltic territory, right at the border between Russia and Estonia, or Russia and Latvia, for example. But then again, unofficially, a lot of people questioned that. A lot of people said, okay, no, more realistically is that Russia would have some initial land gain, and then we have to counterattack through Poland. And then kick out the Russians. And I think with everything that we're seeing in Ukraine right now, how horrible it is to live under Russian occupation, And then also, if you take into account, right, like if they seize a chunk of territory, how this opens up us up to this nuclear blackmail. I think this unofficial doctrine of counterattack is just not feasible anymore. We cannot do this. This cannot be NATO's official or unofficial doctrine. No, we have to make 100% clear, and we have to get ourselves in a position where we are indeed able to counter the Russian attack from day one onwards, right at the border. And we're not going to fall back any substantial chunk of territory.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. And we are also close to another border in this area, by the Baltic countries, because there's also a speciality, I would say, really a special geographic city, and that's Kaliningrad. It's geographically put in between countries, and you have a corridor that's really, I don't know how many kilometers, but it's really narrow, going from Kaliningrad, now under Russia, and then to Belarus, and it's right between Poland and Lithuania. Yes, and can you just tell us a bit about that very strange situation that we have there? Because, I mean, it's a Russian city, but far from Russia itself, and really only dependent on this corridor, that's the Suwalki corridor. And yep. Something about how strategically important is this, and what are the Russians thinking about what they are doing in Kaliningrad, and could this be part of what they see as a possibility of grabbing more land, for instance, around this corridor to make Kaliningrad, and of course that is ultimately also a good way for them to get into the Baltic Sea.
Yeah, so I mean that Suwalki corridor or Suwalki gap, I think it's a prime example of a substantial chunk of NATO territory that Russia could try to seize early on. And right, as you correctly pointed out, it's not substantial because it's large. No, it's only, you know, a couple of square kilometers, but it has a huge military significance because it connects mainland Russia with Kaliningrad. And obviously, it's also politically extremely important because if Russia takes this corridor, it effectively cuts off the land corridor, what connects the Baltics from the larger part of NATO territory. So you know, there would be a lot of incentives for Russia to go for that early. Prior to the war, a lot of analysts have actually pointed out how this corridor really plays a big part in Russian military strategy, because it allows Russia to create this A2AD corridor, which stands for Anti-Access Area Denial. So basically, right, you have Kaliningrad on the left side, you have mainland Russia on the right side, or west and east. And you have substantial denial capabilities like air defense. You have missile capabilities there. You obviously have the broader forces. You also have electronic warfare capabilities. And what NATO was, or NATO analysts, what they were quite concerned about is that Russia could use this position to really pressure NATO in a war, and effectively cut off any assistance from the Baltics, either with seizing that corridor physically or just also by threatening it with these capabilities from both sides. So I think for the larger strategic competition between NATO and Russia, this corridor plays a very, very important role. But I think now, with the war in Ukraine, what happened actually is something quite interesting. For the Russians, it became very clear that, look, this corridor not only presents a strategic opportunity for us, but it also presents actually a very big strategic vulnerability. Right now, this is still under control of NATO. NATO definitely, and especially the Poles, right? The Poles have have massively expanded their military and are still doing so. And no, I have no idea what exactly the Polish military plans are inside NATO planning, but also independently. But I can guarantee that they have thought really, really hard about, okay, how do we defend this corridor and what do we do with Kaliningrad? So they definitely have some contingency plans ready that they can immediately activate, and they know very well what they're going to do with that and how they're going to get around some of these A2AD capabilities of Russia and how they can counter that. And this has created really a sense of vulnerability inside Russia. And again, you know, what you hear with some Russian talk shows now, really the sense of urgency that you have to do something about that. That this is something so significant that it cannot be ignored by Russia. And so again, right, like the overall conclusion here is that, yeah, both sides understand the enormous significance of this corridor. And, you know, in peacetime and in war, this will be a very important geographical area to look at.
Hmm. Yeah, and it's quite close to Norway.
Yeah.
For us, it's important also to follow. Here is a small question extra. We are talking about the Baltic Sea and Kaliningrad, and we just have to mention one more thing, because Kaliningrad, to many people, is the place that I guess nobody even knows where it is, because we don't talk about it much. But what are the Russians actually doing in Kaliningrad? How many people are there? What are the military presence there? What are they doing with the harbor and things? You just mentioned, of course, that they will be closer to Europe in Kaliningrad geographically, because it's close. It's in between Lithuania and Poland, so it's close to us, even close to Norway.
Yeah, so in terms of military capabilities prior to the war, this really has constituted a focal point of Russian rearmament, where they put very specific capabilities there that they would use, including in these scenarios that I outlined. So for example, what you see in Kaliningrad, they put quite a few launchers for short-range ballistic missiles, as well as cruise missiles there that are in range of, you know, like all this critical civilian infrastructure in Western Europe. So if you have like this scenario where Russia might attempt these types of de-escalation strikes to pressure European decision makers or Western European decision makers in particular, it is quite likely that this attack originates in Kaliningrad. And so Kaliningrad really has constituted a really important military base. Obviously, it's more than a military base, but it's been a very significant military sector for Russia. And now with the war in Ukraine, something interesting happened in the sense that Russia obviously was losing a lot of equipment, a lot of forces along the front line in Ukraine, and they had to get additional equipment and troops from somewhere. And given that industry was not able to produce fast enough and people were not trained fast enough, they were looking, you know, from where else can you get them? And some of these troops, some of the equipment that they took to rearm their forces on the Ukrainian border actually came from Kaliningrad. So that especially includes these launchers for ballistic and cruise missiles, but also air defense capabilities, which obviously would be hugely important in a NATO contingency, because they would have to defend Kaliningrad against NATO air power, which is really, really important from a Russian perspective. So that's why this enclave of Kaliningrad really has been weakened militarily in recent years through the war. It obviously still represents a threat, but compared to the threat it posed previous to the war, there is a difference now. And I think from a NATO perspective, it has become more manageable.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that, but then you answered. It's the Kaliningrad is of course still there. It's still a possibility for the Russians, but they need to rearm Kaliningrad in order to make it strong again. And that is, of course, from the NATO perspective, a good thing, because then you might follow what is happening there, and you might, as you just said, be more prepared to do things around this area. But right now, it's weaker than it was.
It is weaker than it was, and as I said, it also represents a quite substantial vulnerability to Russia, because Russia would have to assume that very early on during the war, you would have large numbers of troop concentrations, especially from Poland, trying to neutralize the threat that Kaliningrad poses. So this obviously includes an air power component, but probably NATO would also try very fast to physically get control over the territory. An interesting dimension in that is that you have nuclear weapons deployed on Kaliningrad. So Russia would be able to launch nuclear weapons from this territory, again, using some of these same capabilities that they might use for critical civilian infrastructure strikes. They can repurpose the same systems to launch nuclear weapons. So that obviously, and that makes things, quite a bit more difficult, because from a NATO perspective, you then have to wonder, if I... at one point, will Russia try to defend this territory with nuclear weapons? And that's, dangerous for all sides. And that's why I think the best strategy is to deter a conflict with Russia from the outset. So you don't even have to ask these complicated questions and go into the risk of having some kind of nuclear exchange.
There are certain conditions that have to be in place in order for NATO and Russia to be pitted in a warm war, as we have been talking about. What is more crucial in 2024, 2025? Trump being re-elected or Europe failing to invest in their defense?
Definitely Europe failing to invest in its defense, because this is a variable that we can control. Here we have it in our own hands. What happens in the United States ultimately is right beyond our doing. What we in Europe need to do is, and I always say, hope for the best, plan for the worst. Because right now, what we're literally doing in Europe, and I think this is not underestimating the situation. I think what Russia is doing, they have a pistol or a gun pressed against our chest, and we're looking at the United States and basically hoping for a 50-50 coin flip that the outcome of the next American election will be in our favor. And if you think about that, this is absolute insanity what we've been doing here in Europe for the last 2 years, right? And sure, there are exceptions, right? It's really difficult to generally blame all of Europe equally. The Baltics, the Poles, they've done a tremendous job in understanding the situation and acting accordingly. But what we see in Western Europe, and I think also here partially in Norway, even though I think Norway or traditionally the Northern European countries, they've done a bit better job than the Western Europeans. But I think generally speaking, outside of these Eastern European countries, we've been doing too little too late, and it really harms Ukraine right now. But this is an extremely dangerous situation that we put ourselves in. Again, right? Like it's not trying to say everything is lost right now. But what I'm going to say is we have 2 to 3 years to get things under control and to get ready for these worst case scenarios, whether or not this involves President Trump in the White House. That's a different question. But obviously that could also have huge ramifications, but we should in either case, we should be prepared for both and take our destiny in our own hands.
I think before we end, we can go into a question about Putin again, because imperialism, and we have been talking about this, his ideas about what Russia is and what Russia should be and so forth, has been really an explanation for many people to explain why, or to tell why did Putin do the things that he is doing, and why did he go into Ukraine and so forth. But with the land grab towards the Suwalki corridor, for instance, as a prospect, do you think that Putin is more strategically minded than we have concluded with formally? And I think also another question is that right after the invasion, we also were speculating about Putin being pushed into a corner with no escape. Do you think, and then what a man can do when he's pushed into a corner, at least with Putin's capabilities, could be really dangerous. So is that a misconception? Is he smarter than we thought?
So I think that that question goes into, right, like what Putin is thinking. And I think that is extremely difficult to say. And at best, we can only speculate about that. So what I would advocate for, right, is maybe a bit academic, but like, right, what you say in the strategic studies field is, look, you cannot derive intent of decision makers, so in that case, Putin, by looking in his head. No chance. We cannot do that. Again, at best, we can speculate, and maybe some speculation is a bit more sophisticated than others, but in the end, there will be quite a big margin of errors. So instead, what you do is you derive intent from capability. So you're looking at, okay, if push comes to shove, what is this person who's leading this state capable of? So I analyze his military capabilities. I analyze his strategies, and I proceed from the standpoint that the worst case scenario comes true. And then I prepare myself for that worst case scenario. And I think this is what we need to do in Europe. This is the point where we're at right now. There is no margin of error anymore where we can either assume that, you know, Putin is somewhat defensively motivated and once you know, Ukraine is done with, he will stop for some reason. I don't believe in that, but you know, some people still do. But you know, like, even if they're right, like, okay, let's say for some reason it turns out they're right, I'd rather still want to be prepared for the case where actually I and many others are right, in the sense that no, he's not going to stop after Ukraine, right? So I think right now, even if you believe that after Ukraine, everything stops and we kind of go back to normal and a new normal will emerge where we're all happy and safe again, you still have the responsibility right now as a decision maker to prepare for the scenario where everything is opposite and where there is a huge threat from Russia. Because right now, this is the responsible thing to do.
Finally, in order not to end on such a, it's not a pessimistic note, but it's grim and it can be scary, because it is a scary situation. And what you have been talking about and what you have been explaining to us is of course the capabilities of Russia that could be really far reaching, and of course, or even for installations in the Nordic, in the North Sea or London or Paris or wherever you like, could be just could be attacked in order just to do to follow your plan for what Russia might be capable of, because they are capable of doing these things. But we have some positive things as well. Things have been, there has been things or have been things coming, and you say it's all in our hands. And if we can go into some of the details that are positive that the Western Europeans, NATO, Eastern Europeans are doing right now, that in your view, we should keep on doing even more, even though you have said many things already, if there are details that might be important.
Yeah, no, I mean, things have been improving. I would say so far, you know, not at the speed that is required, but yeah, things have gotten better. I think, you know, one thing that I'm looking at is that, you know, slowly but surely, Europe is getting its ammunition production under control. So we are scaling up, right? We are capable of doing that. So this is the nice thing. I really believe that things are still under our control. We still have agency in this regard. Really, what is required is the political will. And I think if we manage to get this political will together at the required scale, then things can absolutely improve and we can absolutely be able to prepare for these red or crim scenarios. And so I think right now, there's no need to despair. And I actually think, despairing is quite counterproductive. I sometimes explain it like this when people ask me, how can you still sleep at night? It's like, no, this is nothing that keeps me from falling asleep at night. It really is not. Is it something I'm concerned about? Absolutely. But I'm also concerned about climate change, right? But here I also understand, there are still things that can be done. And I have some solutions in my head. And I know that there are many people much more intelligent than I am who think really, really, really hard about these topics and who come up with solutions. And I just really hope that our policymakers, our decision makers, they see that and they share the need for action. And if they do, then I think we can get ourselves on a good way.
We will just have to hope that some of them will be listening to this conversation. And that, of course, read your Twitter X thread, and that the listeners might do that as well if they want to. They could just go into your, might just repeat your Twitter X profile, which is...
It's FR Hoffman 1. So that's the handle, or you just search for Fabian Hoffman and then you should hopefully find me.
That's a good thing, a good place to start, because then you can get the strategy from the Russians that might be possible, and also then push our political leaders to take this seriously. And I have been certainly taking this seriously by talking to you today, and I'm really happy that you came, and thanks a lot for coming, Fabian.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
If you like Liberal Halvtimme, you must rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using my email matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. And information about Civita is available on our homepage. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Du hører på Liberal Halvtimme, en podcast fra tankesmien Civita.